You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
And I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate. Universities are often represented as near monastic havens of pure scholarly research. If that was ever true, it's no longer. Some are raising questions about growing corporate influence in academic research, and higher education may increasingly be on the front line of international espionage as American and foreign intelligence agencies seek access to leading research and researchers on college campuses. Investigative journalist and ProPublica senior editor Daniel Golden examines how intelligence agencies are exploiting American universities in his new book, Spy Schools: How the CIA, FBI, and Foreign Intelligence Secretly Exploit America's Universities. It's published by Henry Holt, and I'm very pleased it brings Daniel Golden back to the show. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
So, I mean, you're delighted to be here, but I can only imagine that you are delighted by, I would think, is unexpected praise from John le Carré.
Yes, he called my book timely and shocking.
Timely and shocking.
Yeah, I'd like to think, you know, his novels, of course, one of their many great attributes is that they show that the amorality on both sides of the spy wars, both the KGB at the time and English intelligence. And my book kind of takes the same perspective. So I reveal sort of new and startling case studies of both foreign and domestic espionage on campus.
Now, I mean, let's just start broadly, and then I want to bring you in and talk about one person in particular, Zha Jinping. But, I mean, should it be surprising that intelligence agencies, foreign and domestic, would be looking at universities and research centers to spy on them, to recruit people?
Well, it makes a lot of sense for them. I think it would be surprising to the general public. But the benefit for intelligence agencies is that universities are sort of open, you know, transparent, sort of globally minded places.
Right.
So they have a huge number of foreign students and professors. And at the same time, they do a lot of Pentagon-funded research, a lot of research funded by the intelligence community. There's kind of a revolving door between universities and governments. So somebody who's a professor one day, maybe a government official the next day. And it's often easier for an intelligence agency to recruit some young, impressionable student or researcher and point them toward the federal government rather than trying to recruit some older official already in the government. So they have a lot of reasons for wanting to focus on universities, and universities aren't that well protected from it.
Mm-hmm. Just ethically speaking, do you think that there's a problem having universities and government entities like the Pentagon working together, or having the Pentagon funding certain types of research and experiments and things?
Well, these can be a problem because the universities are naturally beholden to their funders. So, for example, one case I go into looks at Harvard's Kennedy School, which is kind of the premier public policy school in the country. And what happens there, I found, is that for years, CIA officers undercover, using their foreign cover, enroll in the Kennedy School's mid-career program, which is predominantly foreign, future foreign leaders in government and business and so on. And so under false pretenses, the CIA officers have an opportunity to cultivate people who they can then, you know, use as informants later on. And so, you know, this poses all sorts of questions, for example, about academic freedom, about the integrity of the classroom. And these are serious issues that I think universities should confront.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk specifics. At the start of your book, you describe the case of a University of South Florida professor, Zha Jinping. Can you tell us about him?
Yeah, and this is the case that sort of got me started into this whole topic. And he was is a professor at the University of South Florida, born in China, now a U.S. citizen, and the FBI had been interested in him for quite a while. And at the University of South Florida, he ran something called the Confucius Institute. China funds a lot of Confucius Institutes around the world and on American campuses. And U.S. intelligence is very suspicious of them as being kind of a haven for spies. And he ran the Confucius Institute, and he got into some financial trouble, sort of finagling of expense accounts and the like. And basically, the FBI went to him and said, you know, you've got two choices. You can keep your lose your professorship and go to prison for your financial fraud, or you can keep your professorship and you can spy on the Confucius Institutes in China for us. And the FBI even asked the University of South Florida to set up a branch in China that Pong could use as a base for his spying. So it was kind of a real sort of intervention by the FBI in the university's affairs. And it plays out in a very interesting way, which I'll leave to readers to follow. But he's a very smart guy, Pong, and he kind of played the FBI by pretending to spy but not really doing it and stringing them along. And it makes for an interesting story.
Huh. Well, was he, Tu Jingpeng was, wasn't he dismissed from his position at the Confucius Center, the Confucius Institute in at the University of South Florida?
Yeah, he was dismissed from his position as head of the institute, but he kept his professorship at the university.
So that was separate from the intervention of the FBI.
Well, what the FBI did was keep the university from firing him altogether. You know, the university had to do something about this financial behavior,
right,
and various other allegations against him. So they suspended him, but for a while it looks like he was certain to be fired despite his tenure. And the FBI stepped in and lobbied the university and persuaded them to keep him on.
So where's he now?
He's still at the University of South Florida as a tenured professor. He has nothing to do with the Confucius Institute, but thanks to the FBI's intervention and his own wiliness, you might say, he remains on the faculty there.
So, I mean, okay, so that's where he is now, and now this is all known. Does that not taint him in any way in terms of his colleagues at the university, students? I'm just wondering how all this impacts his ability to teach.
Well, the interesting thing is, you know, what happened was that after a while, ultimately, he kind of had a split from the FBI. And when he told one of the local papers that was doing a story about the punishment he'd received and why wasn't he fired and so on, he said, well, you don't understand. It's all about the FBI. And at the time, everybody at USF basically reacted by saying he's crazy. And I called the university at the time, this was a few years ago, and said, you know, Professor Pong says that all this discipline issue has to do with the FBI. What do you say to that? And basically the university said, we don't know anything about it. And then it turned out when I got the emails involved and other documentation that it did all have to do with the FBI. And in a way, so my coverage of it kind of resurrected his reputation because everybody there thought he had just made up the whole FBI involvement as a kind of excuse for what happened. So now he's kind of rehabilitated in that sense.
I see. And notice you pronounce his last name is Pong.
Yes, that's right.
Oh, okay.
Right.
So I've been mispronouncing his last name. So my apologies to you and to the professor. So a former government official told you that both sides are exploiting universities. Which sides? Them and us? How is he defining both sides?
Well, he's referring both to foreign countries, you know, that are we have some differences with, like Russia and China, and at the same time the CIA and the FBI. So what my book shows and what he's saying, his perspective was very useful, was that Russia, China, and other countries, Cuba, for example, are, you know, seeking research secrets and information at American campuses. And at the same time, the CIA and FBI are recruiting foreign students and researchers on our campuses, often unwittingly or by applying pressure in the case of Pong, and hoping to send them home as our agents so that, you know, both the U.S. and the countries you might consider hostile to us are basically using the same strategies of focusing on academia.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Daniel Golden about his new book, Spy Schools, How the CIA, FBI, and Foreign Intelligence Secretly Exploit America's Universities. It's published by Henry Holt. And Daniel, I mean, there are 16 agencies in the U.S. intelligence community which are known to be working in some way in American universities.
Well, the ones I focus on are primarily the CIA and FBI. You know, some of the other agencies are only focusing on technology, for example, mm-hmm. like NSA. And, you know, my book is about people and, you know, people who are spying, people who are vulnerable and being manipulated. And obviously, there's been a great focus on spying through hacking and spying through technology. But ultimately, human espionage is still a very important element, and that's what I focus on.
Right, because I was going to ask you, like, right now, it seems like the popular perception of espionage now is all about algorithms, hacking, drones, very sort of impersonal ways of spying. And yet you focus on like the very still prominence of human spying.
Yes, I think it still is very prominent. And no matter what techniques are used, there's still humans sort of making the decisions about who to focus them on and what material to gather. And so sometimes we think of it as so robotic that we neglect the human element.
Mm-hmm. I just want to be clear about one thing. You said your book is focused on, even though there are 16 agencies in the U.S. intelligence community, your book is focused on the CIA and the FBI. But to be clear, the CIA is prohibited by law from doing anything domestically. Isn't that right?
No. The CIA has something called the National Resources Division that's very active in the U.S. on college campuses.
Oh.
And they recruit undercover at U.S. Campuses, just like the FBI does. And the FBI is active these days overseas as well. So those lines are much blurred, and often the CIA and FBI on a campus might be recruiting the same foreigner of interest instead of stepping on each other's toes.
Huh.
So the CIA has long had involvement domestically. Now, there are certain precautions and limits on what they can do in recruiting U.S. citizens, but those don't apply when they're recruiting foreign students and researchers. And basically, they recruit foreigners with the idea that they would send them back to their country as our agents, and that's, you know, a major CIA activity in the United States.
Okay, then I guess then maybe what I'm thinking is the CIA is prohibited from spying on Americans domestically or spying domestically. They can recruit, but they can't, actually, they couldn't spy on me or you or anyone here in this building.
Well, I think that what they have to do with U.S. citizens is they have to declare themselves. You know, for example, in the recruiting, which is what I'm primarily focusing on, after a certain amount of time, they have to say to a U.S. citizen, I'm from the CIA. But with foreign students, they can use all manner of cover and guile, and there's no restriction on that.
Okay, so talk about these ways that the CIA, FBI, foreign intelligence entities go about finding recruits and getting recruits?
Well, so for example, you know, standard tactics might be, say they go to an academic conference, and it's a conference of, say, nuclear scientists or physics professors or people who might have secrets that might be very helpful in that regard. Or it might be a conference of, say, experts on the Middle East or something, and they might go with a made-up identity as a consultant in the field, or somebody who's starting a journal or a publication that has to do with that field, and they cultivate the people that the targets that they're interested in, and try to make friends with them, and also get them in a situation where they're paying them for a service. They might say, can you write me an article or offer me your expertise? I'll pay you some money for that. And once they've paid them, they kind of have them, because let's say it's a student from another country, Russia or Iran. Once that person has accepted money from the CIA, they can always be potentially blackmailed. Mm. So that's a very common ruse to find a way to have somebody in your pay without them necessarily knowing who's paying them.
And in terms of, let's say I'm a student at my alma mater, Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota, could someone from the CIA come up to me and try to recruit me in some way?
Certainly. Like I said, if you're a foreign student, they don't have to identify themselves being from the CIA. And they might, you know, often a professor might be an intermediary, and the professor might call the student in who looks to be of interest. Maybe they're related to somebody important overseas. The professor chats up the student and then says, I have a friend who'd like to meet you. And it goes on from there.
And that's a great example of something that a Harvard psychiatrist, Gerald Post, did. And I want to talk about that when we come back from this break. I'm Jonathan Capehart, filling in for Leonard Lopate. And I'm speaking with Pulitzer Prize winning journalist Daniel Golden about his latest book, Spy Schools, How the CIA, FBI, and Foreign Intelligence Secretly Exploit America's Universities. You're listening to WNYC and WNYC.org. We'll be right back after a break. This is the Leonard Lopate Show on WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Jonathan Capehart in today for Leonard Lopate. And I'm speaking with Daniel Golden about his new book, Spy Schools, How the CIA, FBI, and Foreign Intelligence Secretly Exploit America's Universities. Before we went to a break, Daniel, we were talking about how sometimes professors can funnel students to particular agencies. And I mentioned the name Gerald Post. Who is Gerald Post?
Well, Gerald Post is a very interesting guy. He had a long and impressive career at the CIA, kind of heading their activity, providing psychological profiles of foreign leaders. He's sort of a psychiatrist, and it's funny, he told me he got into intelligence, so one reason was because he kept making a Freudian slip when he typed his profession, and instead of saying a psychiatrist, he would type spycatrist. He would flip the letters. So and then eventually, you know, he left the CIA and he became a professor at George Washington University, and there he became a major referrer of students to the CIA and other intelligence agencies. And you know, I forget the exact total. It's in my book, but there's more than 20 people he taught who he then helped get into the intelligence agencies.
So once a spy, always a spy.
Well, you know, Vladimir Putin is famous for saying something like that. Once KGB, always KGB. And I think there is a certain amount of truth to that.
And how did he go about picking which students he would refer to the CIA? Did he have criteria?
I think when he talked about it to me, he mm-hmm. said that it was because the students had expressed interest to him. Now, some of his students tell a different version and say that he sort of tapped them on the shoulder and said, you know, I think this, you're suited to this career. So, and you know, I think the students are probably more believable. He might be underrating his role a little bit, but I don't know the exact criteria, but presumably, mm-hmm. you know, that you can see who has a propensity for that kind of activity.
Actually, I got ahead of myself. I should have asked you. So once he leaves the CIA and goes into academia, George Washington, you know, what's he teaching?
Well, he's teaching courses related to intelligence.
Okay.
And to the psychological profiling of okay. foreign leaders. It was his expertise at the CIA.
And so Loretta Denny, she's a former student of his, of Gerald Post's, and she says that he has been, you quote, part of restoring a historical closeness between the academic community and the intelligence community.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very interesting area that I go into quite a bit in my book, which is back when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, there was a lot of tension between academia and the intelligence agencies, you know, stemming from things like the Bay of Pigs and, you know, the FBI's infiltration of student demonstrations and so on. There was a real split, and there were constant protests against CIA and FBI recruiting and so on. And that has really faded away. And there's been a lot more closeness, particularly since 9/11 and the terrorism attacks. And the universities, the mood there has been more patriotic. And also, there's a lot more funding from intelligence communities for all kinds of research and programs and courses at universities. So academia and the intelligence agencies are much closer together. Actually, the biggest figure in this rapprochement was Graham Spanier, who's now, you know, the former Penn State president, now known mostly for his role in the Sandusky case. But I have a chapter about him called The CIA's Favorite University President. And he, at Penn State, he noticed that the intelligence agencies were sort of coming in through the back door, which they often do, and interviewing students and professors without the university knowing it. And Spanier said, well, I'd rather know it. And so, you know, if I create the front door, maybe they won't come through the back door. So he created a little known government agency called the government board called the National Security Higher Education Advisory Board, or NSHEB. And, you know, that consisted of 20 or 25 college presidents and academic leaders, along with the CIA and FBI. And that was sort of the place where the CIA and FBI would tell university leaders, here's what we're doing. And then Spanier also, he would, if a university wasn't represented on that board, he would often be the intermediary between the CIA and the university and call them up and say, you know, the CIA wants to come and talk to you about something going on in your campus. And he also went around the country giving speeches, telling academia oh, the FBI and CIA, they aren't so bad. You know, they've turned over a new leaf since J. Edgar Hoover. You should get along better with them. But I think that was all well-intentioned. I think the problem ultimately was that the CIA and FBI took advantage of this to go through the front door and let the presidents know. But when it suited them, they still went through the back door and snuck around just like they always did. So I think he showed a certain amount of maybe innocence or naivete, which is kind of a theme in my book. There's quite a few academics dealing with the intelligence agencies or dealing with either foreign or domestic espionage who are kind of naive or maybe a little gullible about what that world is really like.
And the university professor who was going around the country talking about, you know, the CIA and the FBI, they're not so bad, work with them, telling his colleagues around the country, other college and university presidents, was he being paid by the government or by any agencies to do that, or he was just doing that on his own?
I think he was a true believer that mm-hmm. this was the way to go. You know, there had been a variety of scandals where particularly the Sammy Alarian case at South Florida, the same place where Da Jing Pong was, where university leaders, somebody would be arrested on campus for, you know, doing something related to terrorism or espionage or foreign espionage, and the university presidents were surprised by it. And so Spanier said, I don't want any more of these surprises. You know, it's time to have a closer relationship. And I mean, I think he didn't get paid himself. He benefited indirectly in that his relationships with the intelligence agencies probably led to more funding for Penn State research. And he mm-hmm. was the president of Penn State. So hobnobbing with intelligence leaders probably provided, you know, more grants and overall support for the school. So in that sense, it wasn't entirely altruistic.
Right. And, you know, this raises another question here. If say Penn State or any university is getting funding from an agency like the CIA or the FBI or the Pentagon to do all sorts of research and things, I mean, academic institutions are all about the open and free exchange of ideas. And yet we're talking about agencies that have all sorts of levels of classification. And I can only imagine that these the money that's going to fund programs and research, they must be classified. So how does that jive with the traditional role of a university to be open and free and fair? It sounds like elections, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. It's a complicated one. I mean, there are a number of universities that ban classified research, but that number is diminishing. You know, that was an outgrowth of the 60s and 70s. And so a number of universities do more and more do secret research. And those labs are usually pretty well protected. You know, you need security to get in them. The ones that are sort of most vulnerable to foreign espionage are the ones that are doing government-funded or intelligence community-funded research that is actually open but is nonetheless kind of sensitive. So I tell this story in a lot of detail of an episode at Duke University where a Chinese graduate student came to Duke, worked on Pentagon-funded invisibility research, and ended up taking that research back to China, kind of poaching it. He brought in Chinese collaborators. They came and photographed the equipment. Research that Duke did all of a sudden, you know, was showing up in China. The guy sort of tried to manipulate the professor he was working under to come to China and tell them all about his research. Ultimately, he goes back to China, starts a competing institute, patents a lot of research that was basically done at Duke, and ends up as a billionaire with the Chinese government's support. So in that case, a colleague of mine in China helped me out by interviewing him, and his basic defense was, I couldn't be a spy because this research was basic research. It was not classified. But there's still an advantage to having somebody on the inside participating in basic research. For one thing, if you're fast, you can publish it before the original university doing it does. For another, not everything is published. I mean, if you're working on open research, you can see what the what mistakes to avoid. You can see how to do it a lot quicker, which you probably wouldn't see in any finished publication. In this case, the Pentagon got very alarmed when the first article was published, and it showed funding from the Chinese government. And the Pentagon's like, wait a minute, we want to use this invisibility research eventually to cloak like our fighter planes and our tanks and our drones. And why is China funding this? This is for the Pentagon. And the Duke professor also sensed something was wrong, and he banned this grad student from the lab. He took away his key, and the FBI investigated and did an internal video on it called The Theft of a Great Idea. But this case has never become public. I exposed it for the first time. And all that was too late. You know, the guy went back to China, mm-hmm. and they have the research that we were doing. And but it's a classic sort of case study in that regard.
How does a university, how does a spy agency guard against that? I mean, as you're telling the story, I'm sitting here thinking, well, of course that was going to happen, no?
Well, universities need to be more vigilant. I mean, in that case, and typically there was no written collaboration agreement which would spell out what could actually be shared with Chinese scientists and what couldn't be. There's not a lot of attention paid to intellectual property on campus. You know, there's courses on it at law schools, but the scientists who are going to develop the intellectual property often, you know, don't take courses in it, don't know that much about it. And then the penalties. Now, in this case, they took away the key to the lab for the researcher, but they still awarded him a doctorate. And, you know, if you're suspicious enough of somebody, you know, there's no, you know, maybe withhold their degree or even some kind of expulsion or suspension. But universities have a lot of, you know, just as they take a lot of money from the Pentagon and in the intelligence community, they also have financial interests in international expansion. At the time Duke was becoming concerned about this graduate student from China, it was opening a campus in China. Mm. And, you know, they tend to open campuses in places where it's going to be lucrative. They get a subsidy from the local government, or it's in some oil-rich Middle Eastern country. And they want to be international. That's kind of the vogue. So they don't want to imperil either their domestic or their foreign institutional interest by paying attention to espionage. I mean, I'm a believer in globalization. I think it's great for universities to bring in bright minds from all over the world. But, you know, there is collateral damage and side effects, and they should be paying attention to that.
You're listening to Daniel Golden talk about his new book, Spy Schools, How the CIA, FBI, and Foreign Intelligence Secretly Exploit America's Universities. And Daniel, we got a listener called in and sent in this actually interesting thing. A listener says that there was a program developed by Colonel Edward Lansdale, which identified foreign nationals in their own country and used them to be educated here in the U.S. so that when they return home, they'd be advocates for us there. Follow that?
Yes, and that I'm not familiar with that particular program, but it certainly sounds like it would fit right in with the lines I'm talking about. That, and I don't know the date of this program, but you know, what's years ago, before there were huge numbers of foreign students in this country, we were still interested in recruiting foreign students. Our intelligence agencies were, and they would recruit them abroad, at home, at their universities there, because there weren't as many here. And this might be a program dating back from the days where there weren't hundreds of thousands of foreign students in this country to choose from. And so they began choosing them. They chose them overseas instead.
Mm-hmm. So there's this thing called the Five Eyes. And that's, correct me if I'm wrong, the United States, Britain, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. And that is where they cooperate. There's the intelligence agencies all cooperate, and so they all have eyes on not on each other in a nefarious way, but they're all sharing information. Is there a similar thing going on in terms of their work in academia? So does MI6 know that the CIA is on such and such campus trying to recruit and hire and get operatives?
Well, I don't know that for sure, one way or the other. But my guess would be if there was an extremely high-profile person, for example, say, a member of a royal family of another country, that, you know, more than one intelligence service would be interested in that person, and they would have to work out some kind of guidelines for recruiting. Just like, as I mentioned, the CIA and FBI run across each other's steps often, I would think. But, you know, I think also there may be cooperation between, say, the U.S. and Israel. If you're looking to recruit somebody of importance in, say, the Iranian nuclear program who may be a visiting fellow at an American university. And in my book, I have some examples also of where kind of the U.S. and Taiwan are kind of stepping on each other's toes, maybe to recruit some people about China. But I doubt that it extends much beyond the level of those special few people that everybody has an interest in recruiting.
I have to ask you, as we sort of wind down the interview, we started by talking about the rave review you got unexpectedly from John Le Carré, who said your book was timely and shocking. To his mind, why do you think he thinks it's timely and shocking? This is a man who's, you know, written tons of books. His imagination is broad and wild, and yet he focuses on what you've written, which is rich in information and data. Why do you think he thinks it's timely and shocking?
Well, on the timely part, I would say certainly it's timely in a number of ways. I mean, Russia's spying on the U.S. is obviously dominating the news, and I have anecdotes and discussions of Russian espionage on American campuses. The same goes for Chinese theft of intellectual property. You know, another a major topic which I point out is going on American campuses. I also think, the big sort of fault line in the world now is sort of globalization versus nationalism, right? It's the big issue in Brexit, in the Trump campaign, in the French elections. And that's really at the heart of what I'm writing about, because you've got these universities are sort of your classic global jet-setting type institution, and you have these nationalist organizations seeking their own country's interests, exploiting that globalization. So I think he probably found it timely for all those reasons. In terms of shocking, I mean, you know, the vast majority of this book is composed of new episodes that have never been told in public before, and I think that his knowledge is probably primarily England and Europe, and I think to find them going on in the U.S. and some of the things I reveal, I'm glad I could even shock such a sort of hardened and knowledgeable person as John Le Carré.
You were talking about Russians recruiting people on college campuses, and it makes me think of, you know, the possibility of, say, like a Carter Page, who is a foreign policy advisor to then candidate Trump, being an unwitting spy for a foreign power. And I would love to get into that with you, but we're out of time. Dale, I'm so sorry. I'm Jonathan Capehart, filling in today for Leonard Lopate, and I've been speaking with Pulitzer Prize winning journalist Daniel Golden about his latest book, Spy Schools: How the CIA, FBI, and Foreign Intelligence Secretly Exploit America's Universities. Daniel, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks. Great questions. I appreciate it.